News Extra, February 2021. Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 27th of February 2021. My name is Steve and I edit and produce this programme. In this programme we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We'll also have our selection of national radio highlights coming up in the next week, which, as usual, will be read by John. Then we have another item by David Ireson, who talks about the composer George Gershwin. Then we have another article from TNS Soundings about the winter of 1962-63. And finally, we have this week's birthdays and events this week in past years. The music in this programme is called Kira's Ballad and is by Gothby. So now the news, and our readers today are Fiona, Angela, Anna and Wendy.
Hello, my name's Fiona. How many first COVID-19 vaccines have been given in the county? Latest data has revealed that more than 300,000 people across Hertfordshire and West Essex have received their first COVID-19 jab. From a church hall, a theatre, to a football ground and a nightclub, volunteers at COVID vaccination sites have been working hard to immunise people since December. The latest figures, released last Thursday, show that 322,286 people in Hertfordshire and West Essex have received their first dose of the vaccine in one of our 40 vaccination sites in the area, either at GP-run sites or large vaccination centres, pharmacies or hospital hubs. A total of 180,866, that's 95%, of people aged 70 and over have received their first dose, alongside tens of thousands of healthcare workers and patients who are clinically extremely vulnerable. All care homes for older people have been visited by vaccination teams, and those who are housebound have been contacted and offered the vaccine at home. Pamela Kenny, 87, from Hertford, was pleased to get her vaccine at Robertson House in Stevenage. She said, "People were so kind. It's been a good experience. Everyone's been so helpful and the wait has been short. Nothing to worry about." Across the vaccination programme, there are many examples of collaboration, turning halls, offices, sports and entertainment venues into vaccination sites, along with innovative ideas to protect the most vulnerable. These include a drive-through vaccine service at Batchwood Nightclub in St Albans, enabling clinically extremely vulnerable people to get their vaccinations without even leaving their vehicle. More than 3,500 signed up volunteers have also been helping with roles from car parking marshalling to admin support. Dr. Tara Belcher, a GP from Hitchin, said, "It's been a really hard work, but it's an absolute joy and a privilege to be part of the vaccine programme. We've had so much support from volunteers and the local community. People are genuinely delighted to get their vaccine, some of them who haven't been out of the house since last March. We've received wonderful letters and messages of thanks. If you're one of those offered the jab, please come forward. Help us protect you and those around you from this deadly virus."
Hello, I'm Angela, and this article that I'm going to be reading is entitled "We Must Learn to Live with COVID as the Lockdown End Approaches." Following the government's announcement on Monday of a roadmap out of lockdown, Hearts County Council has emphasised the need to remain vigilant against the virus as restrictions are eased. Tim Hutchings, the council's executive member for public health and protection, said, I think it's really important that we just hang on a little bit longer. There's light at the end of the tunnel, and I think now's not the time to be less vigilant. Despite vaccines offering significant protection, Director of Public Health Jim McManus emphasised that learning to live with COVID-19 is the next step, which means maintaining social distancing for as long as necessary and continuing hygiene measures. He said, "The virus is here and it's here to stay for the foreseeable future. Although the vaccine reduces it, it doesn't look like the vaccine completely eradicates transmission yet." Mr. McManus added that, "As a nation, we have been far too complacent about coughs and sneezes and food hygiene," stating that increased hygiene measures due to COVID-19 could cause a general reduction in colds and flu in the future. He said, "People in Hertfordshire have done really, really well. The public are very realistic and cautious, and there's a strong alignment between what professionals are saying and what the public are saying. This plan will only work with residents continuing doing what they are doing." This means people need to get the vaccine when they are told to, need to keep their distance from each other, and need to continue to take hygiene precautions. Tanya Rule, the council's head of school standards and accountability, said Herts County Council will also continue to work with schools to help them adapt when they reopen on March the 8th. She said, "We are working with schools to manage rapid testing and continue to offer support. Schools have been working in this environment for quite some time now, and they adapted to different situations and different guidance and showed a lot of resilience." When schools reopen, secondary school pupils will be tested twice a week. Their first three tests will take place in school, and from then on they will be given home test packs.
Hello, I'm Anna, and the heading on this piece is Batchwood Hall COVID vaccine team warn of potential scam call. A bogus call is potentially circulating in St Albans, where patients are called from an undisclosed number and falsely told that there are no available appointments at Batchwood Hall. St Albans Vaccination Programme, also known as STAVAX, published a tweet warning their patients of the possible scam, which also incorrectly informed patients that they would be vaccinated at home. Dr. Helen McAndrew, joint clinical leader of STAVAX, told the Hearts ad, "With regard to our tweet, we were made aware of a possible scam by one of our collaborating practices, whereby the resident revealed their appointment details to someone who they believed had not identified themselves and who had informed them Batchwood was full, so they were calling to say they would be vaccinated at home. We were aware that our STAVAX team were not involved in this call. There is an issue regarding lack of vaccine supplied that means we cannot vaccinate anywhere near the 2,500 to 3,000 people a day that we have proven capacity for, and thus the site appears to be full, but we would not and did not call to offer housebound vaccination as an alternative, nor ask for personal details to be released over the phone." Dr. McAndrew also explained that the Primary Care Network, PCN, which leads the vaccine rollout at Club Batchwood, has checks in place that mean a resident can only receive the vaccine if they are in the appropriate priority group and if they have a booked invitation-only appointment. "We subsequently received notice of a further possible scam to a different patient the next day," she added. "We again confirmed our team had not been involved in the call and advised that they inform the police. As of Thursday, 16,500 vaccination doses had been administered at Batchwood Hall, with the centre also nationally recognised as one of the best performing in Britain. More than 300,000 jabs have been given across Herts. COVID vaccinations are only available from the NHS and are free of charge. If someone feels that they must have been involved in a scam, then inform both your practice and the police."
Hello, this is Wendy, and my first story is residents' misery after disruption on the former site of wildlife attraction Butterfly World. 5 years on from the closure of wildlife tourist attraction Butterfly World, and the site is once again marred in controversy. For much of the past year, the car park at the 27-acre Greenbelt location has apparently been used for a vehicle recovery and storage facility, overseen by a company called Convene Construction Limited, which granted consent for the site to be used for commercial purposes. According to residents, the rural site is now covered with a variety of vehicles, including trucks, cars and vans, plus fairground rides and portable cabins, with excessive traffic into Miriam Lane and noise disturbance day and night in what is essentially a residential area. When planning permission was granted for Butterfly World in 2005, it was on the condition that it could only be used for purposes directly related to the use of the site for horticulture, horticultural training, research, butterfly keeping, and for visits by the public, and it would be returned to its original state should the venue ever close. And after Butterfly World closed its doors at the end of 2015, owners of the Briony Group told the Hearts Advertiser there were no plans to either sell or develop the site. In December 2019, Convene Construction applied to have the adjoining land excluded from the Greenbelt under the St Albans District Council local plan examination, the broad locations for development. It was not approved by the District Council. Retrospective permission for the facility to operate car van collection, storage and delivery for a 12-month period was finally refused by St Albans District Council's Planning Referrals Committee last week, following delays caused by the pandemic. It was deemed an inappropriate greenbelt development without very special circumstances for approval. This application states the land is still owned by Briony. Neighbours have hit out at the industrial activity on the former wildlife site. Robert Bolt of Forge End said, "I'm upset about the lack of enforcement by St Albans District Council of the original planning condition that if Butterfly World failed, the site would be restored to its previous condition. Failure to enforce at an early stage has led to the present illegal use of the site. This is causing much distress to residents of Longfellow and adjacent streets. Unless this development is nipped in the bud, the old Butterfly World site will offer any excuse for additional housing development in this area, which is outside the current strategic plan." Sam and Gwyn Cross, also of Longfellow, fumed, "What began as a tourist attraction is now a blot on the landscape with disruptive 24-hour traffic movements and noisy building work during the night." Neighbour Sandra Sheldon said, "This is Greenbelt land. It should remain as Greenbelt land. I used to walk my dogs up Miriam Lane until the gates were locked and they took over. There were wildflowers where now there are lorries and rubbish everywhere." Martin Shuttlewood added, "I live close to the ex-Butterfly World property and have seen a huge increase in traffic and noise along Miriam Lane into the site. Convene have a plan on their website for housing on this site. The site is on Greenbelt land and Butterfly World was allowed to use this as an exception, so the residents of Chiswell Green expect the site to revert to Greenbelt land with the immediate removal of these vehicles and activities." St Albans District Council planning portfolio holder Councillor Jamie Day said that the Council's enforcement team is now working its way through the recent activities and uses on the site. He said, "These will be assessed within the parameters of the Local Enforcement Plan 2017 to see if it's expedient to take enforcement action. Taking formal planning enforcement action is a complex process which is likely to take some time. We are advising residents who are adversely affected by noise or floodlighting from the site to contact the Council's Environmental Compliance Team in the first instance."
Threat to neighbouring Greenbelt land from Decorum Local Plan. Thousands of acres of Greenbelt land on St Albans' doorstep are at risk from development. The new local plan proposed by Decorum Borough Council, DBC, threatens to destroy over 850 hectares, the equivalent of 2,100 acres of countryside. This is about 1,214 football pitches, and they plan to do this with 16,000 new homes. Greenbelt land is threatened at Berkhamsted, Tring, Hemel Hempstead, King's Langley, Bovingdon and Markgate under DBC's development blueprint for the period up to 2038. But countryside charity, the Campaign to Protect Rural England, Hertfordshire, says the plan has been calculated on outdated data from 2014 and fails to take into account the redevelopment of existing retail and commercial sites in the borough. The chairman, Richard Bullen, said, "We believe that planning is crucial to empowering local communities and making sustainable, livable places. Ensuring everyone has an affordable home that meets their needs is essential to that, both in town and country. Equally, it is vital that new development is planned intelligently. Our countryside is precious and finite and urgently needs better management in the face of climate and nature emergencies. Critical to this is that the land is not lost to development unnecessarily. More new homes are undeniably needed, and there is plenty of scope to use previously developed urban brownfield land to help address this need." Hemel MP Sir Mike Penning does not think that there is enough brownfield land available. He says, "The need for more local housing is by far the biggest issue my office deals with on a daily basis. We all understand that we need more homes in Decorum of all types, whilst at the same time protecting our local green environment. But unfortunately, there is not plenty of scope to use brownfield sites. In recent years, the council has used more and more inventive ways of freeing up previously built on land. Certainly brownfield sites should be prioritised, but sadly, there just aren't enough." St Albans District Council leader, Councillor Chris White, believes housing targets need to be reassessed. "All district councils in Hertfordshire are under huge pressure from central government to meet housing targets, despite the extent of the Greenbelt. The only way to lessen this pressure is for the government to reassess housing targets. If they won't, as it still seems likely, then there will need to be massive funding for the transport links, the schools, the NHS facilities that will have to go with these new homes." Daisy Cooper, MP for St Albans, said, "Residents are now starting to see the impact of the Conservative government's housing targets on Hertfordshire's Green Belt. I'm proud that here in St Albans, a neighbouring Liberal Democrat-led district council have declared a climate emergency, and we have launched more than 100 climate actions and will build new homes that are climate ready. I would urge my constituents who live in the Decorum Borough to demand similar levels of ambition from their council and respond to the public consultation by the end of February." A spokesman for Decorum Borough Council said, "Although they had identified brownfield sites for the development, it was not possible to meet the housing requirement for Decorum set out in the government's standard methodology using previously developed land alone. The local plan proposes that around two-thirds of all the growth in the borough is on land already allocated for the development in previous local plans. It already has planning permission or it's in previously developed land. This means that will be about a third of new development will need to come forward outside of this existing urban areas."
Have your say on the future of hospital services. Members of the public are invited to submit their feedback on the future of hospital services in our area. Your Care, Your Future was launched by West Hearts Hospital NHS Trust, WHHT, on February the 18th. The proposals for new ways to provide care are being developed alongside rebuild and refurbishment plans for Hemel Hempstead, St Albans City and Watford General Hospitals. The Trust is currently at the outline business case stage of a major bid to the government for funding to refurbish St Albans City Hospital alongside Hemel Hempstead as well as for a transformation at Watford General Hospital, with up to 90% new buildings. In advance of building works, the Trust has reviewed the way services are currently provided and is looking to make a range of improvements, including a higher proportion of single rooms, more one-stop clinics, and more online appointments. The proposals will also see each hospital having a more clearly defined role, with St Albans City being the centre for planned surgery and cancer care. Chief Medical Officer Mike van der Watt said, "Creating a unique role for each site and making sure it has the right staff and facilities to provide an excellent standard of care is the backbone of our plans. I want to thank our busy clinicians for making the time to develop the proposals we are making public today. Despite the pressures, we have had great engagement, and it's clear how committed our staff are to making our services the best they can be. We have reviewed the latest best practice from this country and abroad, and have used that, as well as national policy and our own ideas, to create a vastly improved way of delivering patient care. I am excited by our plans, which are about so much more than buildings and beds. The quality and safety of our services and the clinical outcomes we want for our patients have been our guiding force." A survey will be issued by the Trust to find out what people think of its ideas, and has offered to make presentations to local community groups.
The next article is Vision for the Future. St Albans residents and businesses are being asked to get involved in the creation of a legally recognised, in quotes, St Albans Vision for the Future. A joint venture is being formed between the St Albans BID, the Civic Society, residents and businesses, which will become a neighbourhood forum. They will then create a neighbourhood plan, the vision for the city centre, which can be enforced by the planning authority. Presidents of the St Albans Civic Society, Tim Boatswain, said, "With all the changes that have happened to the High Street because of the new shopping habits, the coronavirus pandemic and the easing of planning controls, it is crucial we have a vision of what our city centre should look like in the future. Otherwise, the danger is there will be arbitrary and poor quality development that will blight St Albans for the next generation. I'm delighted to be chairing a BID steering group to establish a neighbourhood forum which will, through wide consultation, seek to create a plan for the city centre that reflects the values and wishes of the people of St Albans. Portfolio holder for business and a BID board director, Councillor Mandy McNeil, said, "Pre-COVID-19, the Civic Society, which champions our heritage city together with businesses, workers and residents, frustrated by no cohesive vision since 2009, were lobbying for a representative vision for our city, which gave them a voice and had teeth. I was delighted when my colleagues tasked me to help move this forward. The best people to make a plan for our city are those who live and work here. It's an inclusive process. I encourage everyone who is passionate about our city to get involved, as this is a powerful tool for our community to shape our city." Mike Nuttall of Must Wines in George Street said, "In these uncertain times, it's even more important for businesses, societies, residents and local government to work effectively together. This is a terrific platform for us all to create something even more special about wonderful St Albans."
St Albans Charity Challenge with Twin Town Vorms backs Earthworks. A gaggle of St Albans fundraisers have teamed up with residents of our city's Twin Town to raise money for Earthworks. With their annual trip to Vorms cancelled due to the coronavirus pandemic, Lewis Wynne and his team, based in St Albans, virtually, put their heads together to think of other things they could do together, even though they were 500 miles apart. It was from there that the idea of a charity fundraiser was born. 8 St Albans natives and 3 Vorms residents would walk, run and cycle the equivalent distance between the two towns and back. Speaking of how the bond between the two places came to be, Lewis explained, "Me and my group of mates wanted to find something to do together, And 6 or 7 years ago, we decided to go to Worms in Germany because it's our twin town and something a bit different. We developed quite a close friendship with some of the guys out there, so we ended up going to one of the guys' weddings out there, and they came here. The original challenge set would see the 11 participants journey the 926 miles over February and March, but the team are now aiming to walk, run and cycle as far as they can before their deadline at the end of next month. Originally setting out to raise £1,000 to buy Earthworks a new printer, they now set their sights on raising £2,500 for the St Albans-based horticultural and nature-based charity for people with learning disabilities. Participant James Edwards said of the challenge so far, "It has been great to be able to get out and about, knowing every step is a step closer to our 926-mile target. Makes it even more worthwhile when you're raising money for such a great charity." Marcus and Uta Vella and Sven Jorgensen, who live in Worms, added, "After the guys from St Albans came to Germany some years ago, everybody desperately wanted to go to St Albans, but no one could have imagined what great friendships have evolved, and so there is no moment to hesitate and help a good friend with this charity project. Team member Rhys Wynne is also running the London Marathon for Earthworks later this year."
Golf club among the first to run Kickstart job scheme. A St Albans golf club has become one of the first in the country to approved to join the government-funded employment scheme Kickstart. The new scheme means that Verulam Golf Club will be able to employ young local staff members to undertake roles in a variety of departments with all of their salary, uniform and training costs funded by the scheme. The Kickstart scheme is aimed at getting 18 to 24-year-olds into work. It provides on-the-job experience alongside online training courses run by marketing consultancy Promote Golf and offering golf clubs a fully funded staffing solution for when furlough support ends later this year. As part of the funding, candidates will receive training in customer service, health and safety, plus for gamekeeping-based positions, courses will cover turf grass fundamentals, including identification of turf diseases. General Manager Paul Keane said, "We're thrilled to be partnering with the Promote Golf on this new opportunity for UK golf industry. The timing couldn't be more appropriate. With furlough support expected to end in April, this funding will certainly help many clubs to complement staffing levels as we recover from the coronavirus pandemic. And at the same time, it will provide young people with valuable working experience, improve their skill set and future employability. Verulam Golf Course is also developing a new clubhouse facility with improved, larger conference facilities. This will include an integral home of the Ryder Cup Museum, reflecting the founding role played by former club captain Samuel Ryder in setting up what is now the third largest watch sporting event in the world." Paul, the current manager of the club, added, "The club sees this as a major addition to St Albans tourism and plans to work closely with the city's visitor partnership to attract people to the museum and the already established iconic tourism opportunities St Albans provides." And this whole article is accompanied by a wonderful photo of our very own Verulam Golf Club. Taken in the summer, the photo shows the course from the far end with a lovely view of the cathedral poking over the trees.
Embroidery project marks a stitch in time of lockdown. A Harpenden seamstress has created a community embroidery project to mark the legacy of lockdown. Catherine Hall, who runs Some Might Say Crafts tutorials, was inspired to set up a Harpenden lockdown embroidery project to document people's pandemic experiences and their hopes for the future. It has already had interest from more than 100 people, including schools, care homes, church groups, nurseries, scouts and brownies, but she would love to see this number grow. Catherine, 39, said she started the project after being inspired by the book Threads of Life by Claire Hunter, which reveals how sewing has influenced world history over the centuries. She said, "It struck me how different the experience of lockdown is for different generations and circumstances. While some have achingly empty days, others are fraught with homeschool and work. While many have been made redundant, others are being asked to work harder and longer than before. While some crave space away from their family, others are desperate to see loved ones again. I wanted to connect all these different experiences together in some way. Embroidery, my current medium for creating, has been used for millennia to record historic events, for political protest, and as a means of holding on to cultural identity. It seemed to me that lockdown, with its far-reaching effects, was an appropriate subject for the craft. To broaden accessibility for the project, however, there is no need to sew for those that are needle-shy. Fabric painting and appliqué, fabric collage, are also most welcome. I hope the crafting on a united project encourages community cohesiveness in this time of forced isolation. Crafting has also long been associated with mindfulness and good mental health, which seems ever more pertinent given the impact of lockdown. Participants are asked to create two patchwork squares, one reflecting an aspect of lockdown and the other about their hopes for the future. The mother of three added, "I would love the patchwork to grow and reflect as broad a reach as possible across our community, across all age groups and abilities. In fact, you don't even have to sew. Sewing the squares together into panels will create a visual representation of our community's lockdown and their hopes for the future. I hope it will be displayed locally for people to see. I'm also looking at making a catalogue of the squares so people can have a keepsake."
The heading for this piece is Hearts Duo's Little Club Classes Are Proving a Big Hit. Trying your best to keep little ones entertained? With children across the district cooped up indoors under national lockdown, two lifelong friends sought out a solution to the problem. Launched by Sophie Adams and Lucy Spafford in March 2020, Little Club began as a platform to provide free weekly performing arts classes to keep children connected and entertained. Hertfordshire-born and bred Lucy and Sophie had worked together for over a decade at a St Albans theatre school before joining forces last year. With both Sophie and Lucy losing their theatre and vocal work in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, it seemed like perfect timing to set up their business. Initially starting out with free little performer classes via Zoom, the interest in Little Club has snowballed, and the duo hope to launch physical in-person classes when restrictions allow. Through the venture, Sophie and Lucy have also formed a special bond with Crabtree Primary School in Harpenden, with many of the attendees and their parents hailing from the school. The club also now operates in five nurseries, featuring their own collection of Little Club songs written by Lucy herself. They also hope to bring back some performing classes in the near future, with a small fee per class. Sophie said, "The performing arts has so many benefits for little people, but fundamentally it helps to build confidence. It also aids concentration and enables them to express themselves both verbally and through facial expressions and body language." And with their work being so important, Sophie and Lucy will be running a free Easter event, Alice's Easter Wonderland, on Zoom. "Setting up a business together has been the best decision we've ever made," Sophie added. "Our skill sets complement one another perfectly, and we seem to work seamlessly together, which makes us the perfect team. What makes Little Club so different is that we have a genuine passion and love for what we do, and this shines through in everything that we do. We're both very much perfectionists. We strive to go that extra mile for every birthday party that we host or class that we teach." And there's a close-up photo of Sophie and Lucy with their immaculate makeup, sparkling eyes and dressed-up hair.
Sustainability Festival. Local groups are invited to an online event to get ideas, tips and advice about running an activity for the 2021 St Albans Sustainability Festival. The Environmental Festival, which takes place in May and June this year, is aimed at residents, community groups, faith groups and businesses across the district. The creative ideas for SustFest 21 online Zoom event takes place this Thursday, February the 25th at 7:30 p.m. and repeats on Tuesday, March the 2nd at 1 p.m. It is open to anyone interested in learning more about how to take part in the festival, which encourages everyone to live more sustainably and protect the environment. Festival Chair Jill Watson said, "We want to encourage and inspire people to get involved in SustFest 21. Some local residents and groups may feel cautious about organising anything at the moment because of the current uncertainty. Speakers at this event will show how creative COVID-safe events can be arranged without too much work. It will feature several groups with some fabulous ideas to share. It will also explore tools available for running online events and imaginative ideas for outdoor and indoor activities for individuals and households to take part in." Heidi Carruthers, Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust People and Wildlife Officer at Harpenden Town Council, is one of those people speaking at the event. She said, "It's a challenging year, but that won't stop us organising some creative activities to encourage local residents to get close to nature during the Sustainability Festival. I'm looking forward to sharing some COVID-safe tips for people who aren't sure what kind of event they could run or how to do it." The event will include information about the festival as well as guidelines on running an event. Other speakers include Amanda Yorworth from St Albans Friends of the Earth and Nicola Wyeth, the communications contractor for the group, who will talk about how to publicise your festival event.
Tributes are paid to Parish Council Chairman. Tributes have been paid to a stalwart of the community, former St Stephen's Parish Council Chairman George Old, who died last month. George was an active member of the Chiswell Green Residents Association for about 40 years and represented on St Stephen's Parish Council for 28 years, serving as chairman several times. He was instrumental in getting Greenwood Park Community Centre built, and he worked with the council to release some land for the Midway surgery, both great assets to that community. The grandfather played a key role in organising the Millennium celebrations and helped start up the annual carol concert at Greenwood Park Community Centre. He died on the 12th of January, aged 76. He was also a founding member of the Moles Volleyball Club and an ardent Arsenal fan and season ticket holder. The current chairman of Chiswell Green Residents Association, Raj Kaur, said, "He did so much for the community, not just with the Parish Council and Residents Association, but as a resident himself. He was always helping people out and making things happen. He encouraged me to become chairman of the Residents Association, and he became my right-hand man over the years. He did so much work behind the scenes, organising Christmas parties, coach trips to the theatre in London or to the dogs at Walthamstow. Almost every event in the village for the past 30 years, he's been involved in organising. He is so missed." Former St Stephen's Parish Council Chairman Mike Freeman, who served alongside him for several years, said, "George was a stalwart of the community. He was someone who could be relied on. If he said he would do something, he would make sure it happened, and he was the first to put his hand up to support. He was a driving force on the Residents Association and was instrumental in so many good things, from getting the Greenwood Parks Community Centre built and installing the clock in Chiswell Green, to organising carol concerts, big event for the Millennium, and countless other benefits for the community in Chiswell Green, but also in surrounding villages too. We all need more Georges in our community." Traffic was momentarily brought to a standstill in Cheswell Green as mourners paid tribute to George on the day of his funeral. A number of people, all socially distanced, came out to line a section of the Watford Road close to the Three Hammers pub where he had been a regular. They paid their respects to the funeral cortege as it passed on Friday the 5th of February en route to a small family service at West Harts Crematorium. George leaves wife Patricia, daughters Sam and Pippa, and son David, grandchildren Phoebe, Fleur, Scarlett, Nathan and Ray. More than £1,700 has been donated to the Royal National Lifeboat Institution and Blood Cancer UK in his memory.
Valentine's Day quiz raises over £1,000 for St Albans charities. A St Albans woman has raised more than £1,000 for two charities, the Sopwell Community Trust and St Albans and District Food Bank, with her online Valentine's Day quiz. Mum of three, Claire Thrift, decided to hold the live Facebook quiz after feeling useless in lockdown. She said it was good fun. Me and my friends had just had it with Zoom calls, and between us we wanted to do something that injected a bit more fun into the usual Zoom calls and quizzes that we'd been doing. We wanted to do it on a larger scale, and also we were just feeling useless because there wasn't really a way of helping people in the community other than physically going and seeing people, which we obviously can't do. The idea came from that, do something to link the community together. Claire, along with her husband Richard, created a wacky and engaging trailer to promote the quiz using their home studio, combining the family's love of dressing up and video making to raise money for local causes and lift the community's spirits. She said, Valentine's Day is a time of year anyway that people feel lonely and can be isolating enough, even when it's not during a pandemic. So we thought, let's do it on that day. Valentine's Day was going to suck really badly, so it all came together like that, really. The all-important money raised through Claire's quiz will be split between the Sopwell Community Trust and St Albans and District Food Bank. We were aiming at £300, and then we sold that many tickets in the first week. I was very surprised that people picked up on it and wanted to do it. We charged only £3 a ticket, and that meant that anybody could take part. Participants, who hailed from across the UK as well as Norway and France, could also add on a donation when buying tickets, supporting the tight community spirit of St Albans. They were all saying how nice it is that we have such a close-knit community. That's what it was all about, really, highlighting the community. I think that's really come to the forefront during the pandemic. People really do step up here, and they care about making sure that everybody is being looked after.
And now the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Norman Adams, aged 94 years. Jeremy Crook, aged 64. Frank Field, aged 90. And John Hall, aged 91. Now, a little more of our offering by Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of interesting national radio programmes for the coming week.
So time for a look at this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, February 27th, and drama at 3 p.m. on Radio 4, the second and final part of The Beautiful and the Damned, an adaptation of F. Scott Fitzgerald's 1922 novel which charts the jazz age via a glamorous but doomed marriage. We don't often talk about sport, so rugby fans, be sure to tune in to live coverage of the Six Nations on Radio 5 Live. Kick-off between Wales and England is at 4:45 p.m. Commentary on England-Ireland can be heard on Radio 5 Live Sports Extra from 2 p.m. Then an evening of opera on Radio 3 with the New York Metropolitan Opera's 2018 production of Saint-Julien, Massenet's take on the Cinderella story. Massenet wrote his Wagner-influenced opera at the height of his fame, and it was an immediate success. It starts at 6:30 on Radio 3. Alternatively, you could tune to Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m. for Elizabeth Jane Howard Remembered, a 3-hour-long celebration of the author of the Castlereagh Chronicles, who died in 2014 age 90. Back to Radio 4 at 8pm for Meeting Myself Coming Back. This week, Ian Hislop joins John Wilson to review key moments from his life and career, with audio of his young self on stage in a school production of Oliver, through to his role on Have I Got News For You, and his thoughts on press freedom and regulation. And that's followed at 9pm on Radio 4 by the first in a two-part drama entitled The Reserve Rope, starring Damian Lewis as Victorian explorer Edward Whymper. On the 14th of July 1865, he conquered the Matterhorn, but four men died on the descent. Whymper was exonerated, but was left forever tormented by the tragedy. What went wrong and why? On to Sunday, February 28th, the end of another month. Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs this week at 11am on Radio 4 is Claire Horton, the new Director General of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission and previously the Chief Exec of Battersea Dogs and Cats Home. It's repeated on Friday at 9am if you miss it. Drama at 3pm on Radio 4 with the third and final part of the dramatisation of Thomas Hardy's novel Tess of the D'Urbervilles. After her disastrous wedding night, Tess gets a job working on the land of a mean-spirited farmer. More sport. Alternatively, if you're a rugby fan, you can catch up with Six Nations Live with France versus Scotland on Radio 5 Live Extra from 2:45. To Classic FM at 9pm for a brand new series, Julian Lloyd Webber's Rising Stars. The former cellist and conductor showcases 30 of the finest musicians under the age of 30, starting this week with pianist Benjamin Grosvenor, guitarist Younghung Kwang, and violinist Esther Abrami. And at 11:30pm on Radio 3, you can finish the weekend by enjoying Slow Radio Sunday in the Park with. During lockdown, parks have served an important escape for people living in towns and cities, and this soundscape captures park life on a winter's day. The birds, the dogs, the wind in the trees and grass, and something approaching silence. But in the distance, there are bells tolling and the wailing of ambulance sirens. Time for a look at those programmes now, which are broadcast each day throughout the week at the same time on the same radio station. So same time, same radio station, same time. Each day, Monday to Friday. Book of the week at 9:45 on Radio 4 each day is Slow Rise, a bread-making adventure. Adrian Scarborough reads from journalist Robert Penn's account of his search for the perfect bread, a quest that takes him to several countries around the world, including Egypt, Turkey and the States. It's repeated at 12:30 all week as well. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 on Radio 4 is Godrun, the seventh and final series of Lucy Catherine's Viking series, in which Godrun has now given birth at sea and believes her young son is destined for great things. Together they embark on a pilgrimage to Rome, repeated at 7:45 again each night. Composer of the Week at 12 noon on Radio 3 is Richard Strauss. Donald MacLeod explores the composer's early years who, by the time he was 18, had written just a mere 150 works. Then back to Radio 4 at just after midday, each day for the continued reading of Small Pleasures. Claire Chambers' story of unexpected second chances and a virgin birth in 1950s suburbia. Gretchen stays home to look after a sick Margaret, while Jean and Howard drive off together to visit his aunt. Repeated again every night at 10:45pm. A new series at 1:45 each day on Radio 4 is Metamorphosis, How Insects Transformed Our World. Dr. Erica McAllister is the Natural History Museum, explores how research into the world's most populous animals, insects, has led to some truly innovative developments across many branches of science. She starts by examining what the jump of the flea was meant for micro-robots. Over to Radio 3 in concert, Celebrity Choice at 7:30 each evening. Much loved figures from the worlds of dance, drama and the media share some of their classical musical favourites. First off is Darcy Bustle, who reveals some of the stories behind her choices, including the turning point in her teenage years when she was selected to dance to the slow movement of Mahler's Fifth Symphony. And finally on Radio 3 each night, 10:45, the essay, Rain Song in Five Senses. Nandini Das introduces five essays on the power and sound of rain, starting with her very own native India and the deafening, thundering rains of the monsoon season. Monday, March the 1st, a new month, and more radio highlights to look forward to as well. What's no doubt of importance to all of us at the moment continues the global race to deliver a COVID-19 vaccine. Tune in to How to Vaccinate the World, Radio 4, 11:30, Monday, March 1st. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Top of the World. Relationship therapist Gloria takes Sean and Jamie on a mountain walk to try and save their 10-year marriage, in which political arguments and COVID lockdown have taken their toll. A new series at 4 p.m. on Radio 4 is Shockwaves. Artists chronicle how they've responded to the COVID-19 pandemic. This week the programme features author Naomi Alderman, who was 2 years into writing her next book, the fictional story of a flu-like virus spreading across the globe, when coronavirus hit and she felt she had to stop. Just a Minute continues, sadly no longer, of course, with Nicholas Parsons in the chair. Here, Sue Perkins take a turn at hosting the ever-popular comedy show, 6:30 on Radio 4. And finally, for Monday, March 1st, can't believe it is another month, The Wedding Detectives at 8 p.m. on Radio 4. This week, a look at the 1959 high society wedding of Tim and Sonia Bryant. Tuesday, March 2nd, 11 a.m, Radio 4, Club 18 to 30. Yeah, interesting. A look at the shared experiences of people aged 29 to 33 who have had their adult lives hit by the double whammy of the financial crash of 2008 and the huge economic downturn caused by the COVID pandemic. It's repeated following Monday, March 8th at 9 p.m. if you miss it. 11:30 a.m, back on Tuesday, March 2nd, on Radio 4, The Price of Song. COVID lockdowns have led to a huge boom in music streaming, but a huge loss in musicians' earnings from live music. John Wilson explores who is profiting from this as he talks to, among others, a certain Sir Paul McCartney. The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is The Ventriloquist Dummy. Amanda Dalton's drama documentary explores the history of ventriloquism, the relationship between mind and body, and the wisdom of the gut. Law in Action returns for another series at 4 p.m. on Radio 4. This week, a look at the government rules to suppress the spread of COVID-19 and the impact of the legal system. Again, it's repeated on Thursday at 8 p.m. if you miss this one on Tuesday. At 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, the return of the sitcom Reluctant Persuaders, set in an advertising agency. Rupert Hardacre, head of the agency, hasn't been seen for over 2 months, but in his absence, everything seems to be running smoothly. Nigel Havers and Josie Lawrence are the stars. And finally, for Tuesday, March 2nd, why not tune to Radio 2 at 9 p.m. for The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum, featuring classic recordings and special guests. Midweek, Wednesday, March 3rd, in Will Self Takes the Waters at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4, the author is transported to Scandinavia, where he samples Swedish mineral water, Ramlösa, and explores the magical qualities ascribed to water, and discusses a brand of glacial meltwater that comes with an £85 price tag. In Science Stories at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Philip Ball tells of a solar eclipse 100 years ago that transformed our notions to the cosmos and turned Albert Einstein into an international celebrity. Choice of dramas this afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Holding Back the Tide, Nick Warburton's comedy, broadcast in three parts. Wednesday, March 3rd, Thursday and Friday this week, about a couple who inherit a house in Yorkshire with a sitting tenant. John's bravado takes a battering when his past returns to haunt him in episode 1. Or at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, you could listen to Cider with Rosie, Laurie Lee's autobiographical 1959 novel about his childhood in Gloucestershire. It concludes on Thursday at the same time, Radio 4 Extra, 3 p.m. And at 8:05 on the BBC World Service, a three-part series entitled The Compass Under the Canopy, which explores the myriad ways that forests operate in our lives and the life of the planet. Prepare to lose yourself in this enchanting soundscape. Thursday, March 4th, The Confessional at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 is a comedy chat show about shame and guilt hosted by Stephen Mangan. This week, actor David Tennant reveals three stories of embarrassment and shame that he's carried around in secret for years. At 3 p.m. on Radio 4 is Ramblings. Claire Balding accompanies the anthropologist Mary-Anne Okocha in her local stomping ground in Hertfordshire as she tells stories based on the dips, hollows, lumps, bumps and oddly shaped stones they see. And we round off the week, Friday, March 5th, with a drama on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and Gypsy, inspired by D.H. Lawrence's 1926 novella The Virgin and the Gypsy. A handsome gypsy is drawn to the rector's daughter when he arrives one summer at her village. On Radio 4 at 11:30, For the Love of Leo, this is the third series of Michael Chaplin's comedy about widower Leo, who still talks to his wife Tamsin when he's alone. He's surprised to meet a woman from his past in this episode, when all he expected was a haircut. At 9 p.m. on Radio 4 comes the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, Anarchy Must Be Organised, a programme from 2016 which marked the 50th anniversary of the said Bonzo Dog Doodah Band's first professional performance, a look back at the unique brand of art, humour and anarchy the London group offered to the public. And the radio highlights come to a close with Margarita Taylor's blend of smooth classics on Classic FM at 10 p.m. Alternatively, for those that prefer a bit of chat as they wind down, why not tune in to Stephen Nolan at 10 p.m. on Radio 5 Live for news and discussions. As always, may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
Now here's David Arson talking about the composer George Gershwin.
Hello, David Arson here again. I've chosen as my subject today the American composer George Gershwin, and hope you'll enjoy with me the range of his music, from jazz classics to Broadway shows, piano and orchestral works, and even an opera. I'm sure you will recognise this. Rhapsody in Blue, one of his best-known pieces, showing what a singular voice he had. He started life as Jacob Bruskin Gershowitz on the 26th of September 1898 in Brooklyn, New York, and was the grandson, and named after, a Ukrainian-Jewish army mechanic, born in Odessa, who had worked in the Russian Imperial Army for 25 years so that he could earn the right of free travel and residence as a Jew, retiring near St. Petersburg. His son worked as a leather cutter for a firm making women's shoes, and he fell in love with Rosa, the daughter of a furrier in Vilnius. Her family moved to New York because of increasing anti-Jewish sentiment in Russia, and he was faced with the prospect of compulsory military service if he stayed in Russia. As soon as he could afford it, he therefore moved to America to be with Rosa, and changed his first name from Moishe to Morris, living in Brooklyn with an uncle and working as a foreman in a woman's shoe factory. He married Rosa in 1889. She had changed her name to Rose, and they Americanized his surname to Gershwin. Their first child, Ira, was born in 1896, and Jacob, George, was their second child, and only changed his name to George when he began to work in the music business. He and his brother Ira, because they lived in and around the Yiddish theatre district, often went to the theatre, and George sometimes appeared on stage as an extra. Up to the age of 10, he spent his time, as did many boys in that district, playing in the street, roller skating, and generally getting into trouble. When he was 10, he heard a violin recital given by his friend Maxie Rosenzweig. He was captivated by the sounds and the way that Maxie played. Around this time, his parents bought a piano for his elder brother Ira, but it was George who spent a lot of time playing it, somewhat to Ira's relief. George tried various piano teachers with some frustration until he found Charles Hambitzer, the pianist in the Beethoven Symphony Orchestra, who until his death in 1918 taught him conventional piano technique, introduced him to the music of the European tradition, and encouraged him to attend classical concerts. In 1913, George left school at the age of 15 and found work as a song plugger for J.H. Remick & Co., a Detroit-based publishing company with a branch office in New York's Tin Pan Alley, so-called because it was the centre of New York music publishing world, which dominated the world of popular music in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Denmark Street became known as Tin Pan Alley because of the noise of so many songwriters bashing out their tunes. Gershwin's first song was published in 1917, when he was 17. It was called When You Want 'Em, You Can't Get 'Em, and When You've Got 'Em, You Don't Want 'Em, and earned him the princely sum of 50 cents. In 1916, he started working for the Aeolian Company and Standard Music Rolls in New York, recording and arranging. He produced many piano rolls, some of his own music. In 1919, he had his first success with a song called Swanee. The Broadway star Al Johnson heard him perform it at a party and decided to include it in his own show. A lucky break, but well deserved.
I've been away from you a long time. I never thought I'd miss you so. Somehow I feel your love is real. Near you I want to be. The birds are singing, it is song time. The banjo strumming soft and low. I know that you yearn for me too. Swanee, you're calling me. Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee. I'd give the world to be among the folks in D-I-X-I, even though my mammy's waiting for me, praying for me down by the Swanee. The folks up north will see me no more when I get to that Swanee shore.
In 1924, Gershwin composed his first major classical work for orchestra and piano, Rhapsody in Blue, which was premiered by the Paul Whiteman Concert Band. The serious music played in America in those days was composed by people either European or dead, or both, so new American music was quite an event. In the audience for the concert, when Rhapsody in Blue was first played, were the violinists Fritz Kreisler and Jascha Heifetz, the conductor Leopold Stokowski, and the composers John Philip Sousa, Igor Stravinsky and Serge Rachmaninoff. Quite a lineup. It established Gershwin as a composer capable of blending different styles, and it went on to be his most popular work. It was even played at the opening of the Los Angeles 1984 Olympics in true American fashion, with no less than 84 grand pianos, all played by pianists wearing white tailcoats. The same year, 1924, he and his brother Ira produced a stage musical comedy, Lady Be Good, which contained the songs Fascinating Rhythm and Oh Lady Be Good, which went on to become classics. They also produced Funny Face and Strike Up the Band. Despite being embarked on a successful career as a writer for shows, in the mid-1920s Gershwin went to Paris with the intention of studying with Nadia Boulanger. She declined to teach him, saying that it might detract from his already successful style. Maurice Ravel, with whom he also tried to study, said, Why become a second-rate Ravel when you are already a first-class Gershwin? While there, he wrote An American in Paris, which received mixed reviews at its first performance in Carnegie Hall in 1928, but went on to become a standard of the orchestral repertoire. Let's hear the start of it. Walter Damrosch had asked Gershwin to write a full concerto following the success of Rhapsody in Blue. Gershwin scored the piece for a normal orchestra, plus celesta, saxophones and automobile horns. He brought back four Parisian taxi horns, which were used in the first performance in Carnegie Hall in 1928, with Damrosch conducting the New York Philharmonic. The taxi horns give the piece a certain colour. Gershwin didn't particularly like Damrosch's interpretation of the piece, saying that it was too slow. "It's not a Beethoven symphony, you know," he said. "It's a humorous piece, nothing solemn about it. It's not intended to draw tears. If it pleases symphony audiences as a light, jolly piece, a series of impressions musically expressed, it succeeds." When it was recorded in 1929, the conductor must have fallen out with Gershwin because he asked him, there to supervise, to leave the studio, but later had to ask him to come back and play the celesta as they were short of a player. So Gershwin did actually play on the first recording. In 1951, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer released the musical film called An American in Paris, starring Gene Kelly and Leslie Caron. It won the Best Picture Oscar and numerous other awards. The film ended with an elaborate dance sequence built around Gershwin's score. In 1929, George and his brother Ira put on a musical called Showgirl, and the following year, Girl Crazy, which included I Got Rhythm and Ginger Rogers singing Embraceable You. I Got Rhythm has appeared in many forms, as a song, as a piano solo, a band number, and arrangements for choirs. I've chosen a version by Judy Garland.
Days can be sunny with never a sigh. Don't need what money can buy. Birds in the trees sing their day full of song. Why shouldn't we sing along? I'm chipper all day, happy with my lot. How do I get that way? Look at what I've got. I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man who could ask for anything more. I got daisies in green pastures, I got my man who could ask for anything more. Old Man Trouble, I don't mind him, you won't find him round my door. I got starlight, I got sweet dreams, I got my man who could ask for anything more. Who could ask for anything more?
George spent the summer of 1931 in South Carolina, having been invited by Dubose Heywood, the author of a novel entitled Porgy. He was inspired to write the music for his opera Porgy and Bess while on this working vacation. The libretto for Porgy and Bess was written by the author and Ira Gershwin and based on the play, which was in turn based on the book. The cast were classically trained Afro-American singers, and this was a first, a daring artistic choice at the time. And after its first performance in Boston in September 1935, it moved to Broadway. The initial public reception was mixed, to say the least. The critics were somewhat perplexed by the work, not knowing whether to regard it as an opera or a serious musical, an ambitious Broadway show. Perhaps because of this, it was not at first a commercial success, though of course it did become an American classic with such numbers as Summertime. In 1943, it had its European premiere, being performed in Copenhagen with an all-white cast blacked up, but after 22 sold-out performances, the Nazis forced the theatre to close. Other all-white productions took place in Zurich, Gothenburg and Stockholm. There was a touring production in 1952 which visited London, Venice, Paris and Moscow, but it was not until the Houston Grand Opera Company put it on in 1976 that it became the popular opera which it now is. Here's the end of the opera as Porgy in some productions drops his crutches behind and staggers off the stage. George moved to Hollywood in 1936, commissioned by RKO Pictures to write a score for the film Shall We Dance, which starred Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. The score, which lasts over an hour, took George many months to complete, and it combines ballet with jazz in a new way. Early in 1937, George began to suffer from blinding headaches and what he described as the smell of burning rubber. In February of that year, he was performing his piano concerto with the Los Angeles Philharmonic under Pierre Monteux and had coordination problems and had a blackout during the performance. He was at the time working on other Hollywood film projects and was living with Ira and his wife Leonora in Beverly Hills. Leonora was very disturbed by George's mood swings and his seeming inability to eat at the table without spilling his food. She suspected mental illness and had him moved to the unoccupied house of a lyricist friend of theirs, where he was looked after by his valet, Paul Müller. His health never recovered after a collapse, and he eventually died of what his doctors thought was a brain tumour at the age of 38. A memorial concert was held at the Hollywood Bowl in September 1937, conducted by Otto Klemperer, who conducted his own orchestration of the second of Gershwin's three preludes. What sets Gershwin apart was his ability to blend the influences of Tin Pan Alley and jazz into his own unique style. Although George Gershwin seldom made grand statements about his music, he did say that true music must reflect the thoughts and aspirations of the people and the time. My people are Americans. My time is today. Who else could have written so many great songs? Here's just a final taste of Gershwin's genius in one of the last songs that he wrote, and sung by the incomparable Frank Sinatra.
There are many, many crazy things that will keep me loving you. And with your permission, may I list a few? The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me.
I hope you've enjoyed this brief glimpse into the life and music of possibly the greatest American composer. Someone whose unique voice, more than any other, captured what it was to be American at the beginning of the 20th century. Thanks for listening.
Now, we have an article from TNF Soundings about the big freeze of the winter of 1962-63.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Nikki, and here is an extract from a Sunday Times article, The Deep Freeze. It's from Juliet Nicholson's book Frostquake, The Frozen Winter of 1962, and how Britain emerged a different country. The winter of 1962-63 was one of the coldest Britain has known. After a week of catastrophic lung-clogging smog in early December, in which many hundreds of people lost their lives, snow began to fall on Boxing Day 1962, and did not stop for the next 10 weeks. With blizzards, treacherous ice, and temperatures lower than minus 20 degrees Celsius, at times the entire country was paralysed. Aeroplanes were grounded, trains, lorries, and cars came to a halt. Animals struggled to survive. Many people, especially the elderly, were confined to their homes. Schools were closed. Families were separated, unable to travel to see each other in such exceptional weather. With an exchange of a lethal virus for freezing temperatures, the upheaval of 1962-63 is reflected uncannily in the chaos caused by the COVID crisis. For many of those who had fought in or lived through one or both world wars, that interminable winter felt like the ending of a way of life, of certainty, of the old way of doing things. And for those who had been hopeful about the new decade of the 1960s, the very real prospect of a nuclear conflict was starting to shake their optimism. The winter crystallised a growing tension between the old and the new. Wherever possible, post-war Britain was trying to catch up with the pacey, modern, convenient world we saw across the Atlantic. As the old industries of steel and shipping declined and Victorian factories gave way to scientific advances, office blocks of shining glass and chrome were built. Ownership of television sets, refrigerators, and other labour-saving gadgets was on the rise. This was a winter in which the old structural pillars of class and entitlement were starting to crumble. What had been correct, the acceptable norms around clothes, accents, sex and class, was being upturned. I was 8 years old that winter and can remember the feeling of living on an edge. We were living at Sissinghurst, a country house in Kent, with my recently widowed grandfather, the writer Harold Nicholson, who, like so many of his generation, was bemused and confused by a world he found unrecognisable. Grieving for his wife, the novelist and poet Vita Sackville-West, and struggling to understand his part in a new environment, his despair was my education in the power of compassion. On Christmas morning, we went to church in the village because it did not feel like Christmas unless we followed the rituals, ate mince pies and sang Hark the Herald Angels Sing. There had been reports of snow cutting off 30 villages in the Abruzzi Mountains in Italy and temperatures dipping overnight in Portugal to minus 15 degrees centigrade. Snowfall in Germany was breaking all records and wintry conditions in Greece had put the country on a state of national alert. 10 deaths from cold had been reported in France on Christmas Day. At the end of Boxing Day, as the huge oak door to the big room at Sissinghurst was closed, the air outside appeared to fill with small white butterflies as the first fragile flakes began to flutter down. The following morning, snow muffled all sound, and the silence felt dream deep. We tipped backwards onto the lawn, arms outstretched like acrobats, trusting that the mattress of snow would break our fall. Down by the moat, the naked statue of Dionysus was clothed in a perfectly fitted white furry coat. By the end of the bank holiday, in parts of the south of the country, snowfall already measured 2.5 feet. Families and friends who hoped to get together or longed for the annual enforced sociability to be over faced disaster. With some unable to get to the holiday sanctuaries they had intended to visit, others were trapped in family prisons from which they longed to escape. On December the 27th, the Times reported that every county in England had been affected in some way by snow or ice, with Dorset, Devon, Kent, Surrey and East Sussex the worst hit. In Kent, the cold had been creeping up to Herne Bay since before Christmas, and it had become possible to walk a full mile on ice from the beach out into the open sea. In the plummeting temperatures of Devon, the keepers of the 4 wild apes at Paignton Zoo were on 24-hour patrol in case the animals made a dash for freedom across the frozen moat that separated them from the public. The zoo's elephants shivered a little less after being given a tot of warm rum with their breakfast. Throughout January, in factories and coal mines, on land and road, at airports and out at sea, the consequences of the big freeze were being felt. 20,000 driving tests were cancelled during the first week of the new year. In one spell, snow fell on Exmoor for 36 continuous hours. In Oxford, homeowners on the banks of the Thames drove their cars across the frozen river to meet friends living on the opposite side. Birds caught in freezing air currents fell to the ground like bricks. Newborn chicks and ducklings, abandoned by their mothers, were wrapped in woolen hats and occupied the airing cupboards on many a farm. I had not been looking forward to going back to my own London school, although I loved the journey. Travelling there through the snowy streets on the top of the 33 bus, I felt at my most independent 8-year-old self, handing over threepence for the flimsy paper ticket. There was no school uniform, and as often as I could, I wore my favourite red woolen mini dress, a shirt waister with silver buttons down the front. I had mastered a new language copied from the older girls during the school lunch break. Super, I would say at home instead of yes please, when asked if I wanted another helping of potato. Groovy was my casual response to an inquiry about my day at school, each such answer received with either incomprehension or a satisfying wince of adult disapproval. School children were not the only members of the population for whom life had resumed after the Christmas holidays. After 5 weeks of snow, members of the Houses of the Commons and Lords had returned to the green and red benches of Westminster. But the business of politics continued to run up against major obstacles abroad as well as at home. The Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, usually a man of publicly equable temperament, was not always able to hide the challenges he now faced, including that of helping smooth Britain's application to become a member of the European Economic Community. The Labour leader, Hugh Gaitskell, opposed Macmillan's view, arguing for Britain's continuing independence. In reply, Macmillan emphasised the necessity of joining the EEC, and in his diary repeated his conviction that for Britain to stay out and isolate herself from the mainstream of European strength would, I believe, have very damaging results, both for ourselves and for the whole of the Commonwealth. The country's morale, eroded by the freezing temperatures, was made worse by the intermittent electrical strikes. During the sixth week of snow, the weather forced the cancellation of most of the weekend's sporting fixtures, crushing the enjoyment of fans when 55 football games failed to kick off. In Brighton, an enterprising builder who sat on the local football club's board attempted to defrost his home pitch with his professional tarmac laying equipment. Unfortunately, the pitch did not survive. On January 1, 1963, the Beatles had arrived back from Hamburg. They had hoped to start the new year with a gig on January 2 in the small town of Keith in northeast Scotland, but the snow meant their flight to Edinburgh had to be rerouted to Aberdeen and the gig was cancelled. However, on January 3, they had made the 150 miles to the Two Red Shoes Ballroom in Elgin. Despite the weather, an audience of 200 turned up. But the following day, just 50 miles away in Dingwall, the fans numbered only 20. Outside Scotland, the band's prospects were more encouraging. The wife of Harry Evans, campaigning editor of the Northern Echo, was a Liverpudlian and had insisted that the Evans family watch the Beatles' first appearance on Granada TV in October 1962. Harry encouraged one of his fledgling photographers, Ian Wright, to track the group, and on February the 9th, Ian heard that the Beatles were playing in Sunderland. He bicycled for 3 hours as he negotiated the 30 or so miles in the atrocious weather from Darlington to the Sunderland Empire. After a set that included Love Me Do, Please Please Me, Twist and Shout, Roll Over Beethoven, and Please Mr. Postman, Ian rushed backstage. As John Lennon answered Ian's knock on the changing room door, the cameraman suggested photographing the four guys inside the old-fashioned theatre lift. Ian took just one shot, as a flash the size of a Bentley headlamp temporarily blinded the four of them. As the Beatles began to move off, rubbing their eyes, Ian shouted, "Stop, stop, I need your names," suddenly confused about which Beatle was which. After Ian's photograph of the Beatles in the lift appeared in his paper's new teenage supplement under the caption, "On Their Way Up," Harry advised Ian to keep the negative somewhere safe, just in case it had some future value. On Wednesday, March the 6th, after 63 consecutive days of frost, Britain woke up to a warmer world. The country was basking in its first frost-free night since before Christmas. The thaw had been gradual, as different pockets of the country were liberated from the harshness of the winter over the preceding few days. On that day at Sissinghurst, Harold's daily diary entry, which had shrunk along with his increasingly empty life over the past few months to nothing more than a few lines, described the purple and white petals of the crocuses in the orchard, which were at last beginning to unfurl. Little by little, a national realisation developed that the Great Freeze, as the papers were now calling the past 10 weeks, was over at last. The ice had finally broken. The time had come for music and dance.
DNF Soundings.
Now we have our piece of music, Kira's Ballad by Gothby, in its entirety.
Thank you.
And now here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 28th of February 1931, Peter Alice, former English professional golfer, television presenter, commentator, author, and golf course designer, was born in Berlin, where his father was a golf professional. Between 1952 and 1969, Alice won 20 professional tournaments, including three British PGA championships in 1957, 62, and 65. And on his retirement from playing, he became a full-time broadcaster, working not only for the BBC, but also other organisations in the USA, Canada, and Australia, becoming known as the Voice of Golf. He died on the 5th of December last year at the age of 89. On the 1st of March 1929, Georgi Markov was born in Sofia, Bulgaria. Markov was a journalist and broadcaster who defected to Britain in 1968. He worked for the BBC World Service and other broadcasters, for whom he wrote many articles critical of the communist regime in Bulgaria at the time. He became famous with his death in 1978, when, while waiting for a bus, he felt a sting, like an insect bite, in the back of his right thigh. A man behind him picked up an umbrella from the ground and hurried off. He became ill that evening and died 4 days later. After his death, an autopsy found a tiny pellet in the tissue of his thigh, and it was speculated that it contained the deadly poison ricin. The incident became known as the umbrella murder, after the assumption that the umbrella had been used to inject the pellet. On the 2nd of March 1968, Daniel Craig, the actor, was born in Chester. He trained at the National Youth Theatre and graduated from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama in 1991, before beginning his career on stage. He rose to fame on TV playing Geordie Peacock in the highly acclaimed drama Our Friends in the North. However, he is of course best known for playing James Bond. His debut film, Casino Royale, was released internationally in November 2006 and was extremely well received, earning him a BAFTA nomination. His third Bond film, Skyfall, premiered in 2012 and is currently the highest-grossing film in the series and the 27th highest-grossing film of all time. On the 3rd of March 1847, Alexander Graham Bell was born in Edinburgh. He was an inventor, scientist, and engineer who patented the first practical telephone. Whether or not he actually invented it is a matter of some debate. The Bell Telephone Company faced 587 legal challenges to its patents in the first 18 years of its existence. Bell considered the telephone an intrusion on his real work as a scientist and refused to have one in his study. Many other inventions marked Bell's later life, including groundbreaking work in optical telecommunications, hydrofoils, and aeronautics. On the 4th of March 1951, Kenny Dalglish, or more properly, Sir Kenneth Matheson Dalglish, the Scottish former football player and manager, was born in Glasgow. He made more than 300 appearances for Celtic and Liverpool, and earned over 100 caps for the Scotland national team. He's been inducted into both the Scottish and English Football Halls of Fame. Dalglish began his career with Celtic in 1971, going on to win 4 Scottish League Championships, 4 Scottish Cups, and 1 Scottish League Cup with the club. He moved into club management with periods at Liverpool, Blackburn Rovers, Newcastle United, and again at Liverpool. Having been sacked in 2012, Dalglish returned to Anfield in 2013 as a non-executive director, and had Anfield Centenary Stand named after him in May 2017. On the 5th of March 1948, Elaine Page, the singer and actress, was born Elaine Jill Bickerstaff in Barnet. She rose to fame playing Eva Perón in Evita in 1978. This was followed by many roles in productions such as Cats, Chess, Anything Goes, Sunset Boulevard, and many others. Her career has spanned more than 50 years. On the 6th of March 1946, David Gilmour was born in Cambridge. He is a guitarist, singer and songwriter who is a member of the progressive rock band Pink Floyd. He joined the group in 1968 when their guitarist, Syd Barrett, began to suffer with mental health problems. Pink Floyd achieved international success with albums such as The Dark Side of the Moon, Wish You Were Here, The Wall, and The Division Bell. Gilmour has produced a variety of artists, such as the Dream Academy, and has released 4 solo studio albums. He's also credited for bringing singer-songwriter Kate Bush to public attention. In 2011, Rolling Stone magazine ranked him number 14 in their list of greatest guitarists of all time. Over the years, Gilmour made sure that Syd Barrett received all the royalties he was due from his time in Pink Floyd. In 2003, Gilmour has made a CBE. He is married twice and is the father of 8 children. And finally, some notable events which occurred this week in the past. On the 28th of February 1975, a London Underground train failed to stop at the southern terminus of the Northern City Line at Platform 9 of Moorgate Station. 43 people were killed and 74 were injured. The train was travelling at between 30 and 40 miles an hour when it hit the buffers, and the impact was so severe that it took 4 days for all the victims to be recovered. There was no apparent mechanical defect with the train, and the cause was put down to driver error, though why the driver failed to stop has never been satisfactorily established. On the 1st of March 1966, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, James Callaghan, announced the historic and momentous decision to change to decimal coinage. The old system of 12 pennies making 1 shilling and 20 shillings making 1 pound would be changed to the one we now know. And that change eventually took place on the 15th of February 1971. On the 2nd of March 1933, the film King Kong was released. The story of the huge gorilla-like animal that falls in love with a human woman was groundbreaking in its use of stop-motion animation and other special effects, and is widely seen as one of the most important films ever made. So much so that in 1991 it was deemed culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant by the United States Library of Congress. On the 3rd of March 1951, Rocket 88, widely regarded as the first ever rock and roll record, was recorded by Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats at the Memphis Recording Service, later known as Sun Studios. The Delta Cats was fronted by a young Ike Turner, who also wrote the song. Ike, of course, later formed a partnership with his wife, Tina. On the 4th of March, 1890, the 4th Bridge was opened by the Duke of Rothesay, the future King Edward VII. It took 8 years to build and is just over 1.5 miles long, with the railway tracks being 150 feet above the Firth of Forth. In 2016, it was voted Scotland's greatest man-made wonder and is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. On the 5th of March 1936, the prototype Supermarine Spitfire made its first flight. Probably the most legendary aircraft to fly with the RAF in the Second World War, it was regarded as the RAF's mainstay during the Battle of Britain, even though the Hawker Hurricane was far more numerous. It continued to be developed and improved throughout its life, and continued in service with the RAF until the 1950s. On the 6th of March 1964, boxing legend Cassius Clay announced he had joined the Nation of Islam and had changed his name to Muhammad Ali, calling his former title a slave name. In 1966, Ali refused to be drafted into the US Army, citing his religious beliefs and ethical opposition to the Vietnam War. He was convicted of draft evasion, and though he didn't go to prison, he was stripped of his boxing titles and didn't fight for 4 years. His conviction was overturned in 1971. He was involved in what are regarded as some of the greatest boxing matches of the 20th century, against opponents like Sonny Liston, Joe Frazier, and George Foreman. And with that, we finish this programme. Many thanks to Fiona, Angela, Anna, and Wendy, our readers today, to Angela again for providing the radio listings, and to John who read them, to Mark who makes all the copies of the programme, and to Michelle, who ensures that you get yours. But that's all from News Extra for February 2021. Goodbye.